Hey gang, before we get into the episode, just a quick reminder that the podcast is sponsored essentially by you. And by your support, and the best way that you could support it would be to head over to the Intensive Care Academy, where you can subscribe as a member and enjoy access to our full library of video lessons on critical care topics, ranging from everything from how to place a line to how to treat pneumonia. We have an entire orientation course available right now for new critical care APPs and content that's relevant to everyone from students to physicians to nurses. Private podcast feeds, access to us for live Q&As, and a whole bunch more. Go check it out if you have not, ICU101.com. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world. Welcome back, everybody. It is Brandon Odo back here with Brian Bowling.
Hey, everyone.
And we're going to chat today about how to keep patients awake and functional and moving around. We have Kaylee Dayton here, who we had on the podcast, I don't know, 2-3 years ago already. But, you know, she's a nurse practitioner in critical care who is... has her own podcast. She does the Walking Home from the ICU podcast about similar topics, and has really, at this point, the main thing she's doing is trying to help other ICUs and clinicians get better at these exact skills, what she calls running an awake and walking ICU, where the majority of your patients are, rather than laying in bed comatose all the time, are awake, interactive, not delirious, moving around, and kind of maintaining a level of function which both helps prevent a lot of the iatrogenesis we see and also optimizes their recovery after their peak of critical illness. That's all well and good. You know, it's been a hot topic. We talk about it on the show sometimes. SCCM has been promoting this for a long time now as ICU liberation, which is not one of the beachfronts in World War II France, but is sort of a mindset, and their A through F bundle and so on. But a lot of it really comes down to practical skills. You know, it's easy stuff to talk about, but often hard stuff to actually do, which of course is why it helps some places out by consulting. But we wanted to get into some of that today. You know, what do these cases actually look like, and what are the optimal ways to tackle them? So Kaylee is actually going to flip the script on us a little bit and walk us through some cases, and we'll see if we could all learn something from it.
So this case study is from a team that I have trained. When I consult with teams, I have them send their normal case studies. I say, send me some examples, go through your medical records, here's the information that I want. I want to understand what you guys are currently doing. Because we know the ABCDF bundle, there is a spectrum of compliance. And many teams will say, yeah, we practice the bundle. What I find is that they have mandated charting, CAM, RAS, SAT, SBT, even early mobility, but their patients are still sedated and not mobilized. So I try to have them show me what they're doing. What does that actually look like? So this is from one of the many teams that I've trained. This is not to blast one ICU. I could have picked a case study to share from any of the teams that I trained. I just thought this one really showed some things that I commonly see that are problems. So in episode 31 of your podcast, we go through a very optimal study or example of how it should look, how the bundle should be applied. This does the opposite, but I think there's a lot to learn. I think we don't always recognize where we're going wrong when it comes to the ABCDF bundle. So Diane is a 54-year-old female with a history of methamphetamine abuse. She lives with her friends in a trailer park and works as a marijuana washer. She has a son that lives an hour away from her. She weighs 110 pounds. She arrived to the ED on the evening of June 17th with shortness of breath and hypoxia. She requested to be intubated. Following intubation, she was on an FiO2 of 90% and a PEEP of 10. She was admitted to the ICU last night for acute respiratory failure secondary to multifocal pneumonia, septic shock, and AKI. Toxicology screen was positive for methamphetamines and THC. So on day one, she arrives to the ICU. Once the dust had settled, she ended up being on a PEEP of 10, FiO2 90%, 40 of propofol, 75 of fentanyl, norepinephrine at 14, and vasopressin at 0.03. and we kept her there. Didn't touch her, thought, don't rock the boat. She's a methamphetamine user, so we don't want to mess with her. Her RAS is charted at a -2. Day two, now she's at a PEEP of 8, an FiO2 of 50%. RAS is still -2. Propofol is at 30, fentanyl is at 50. She gets a total of 6 milligrams of Versed pushes throughout those 24 hours. Levofed's down to 12. Vasopressin is still at 0.03. She does not get, at least according to the charting, any SAT, SBT, no CAM screening, no early mobility. Day three, now she's at an FiO2 of 40%, pressure support of 5, PEEP of 8. RAS is documented at a -2 to +1. Propofol is at 30, fentanyl is at 25 to 50, levofed's at 2, vasopressin is off. According to the charting, the propofol was off for about an hour and a half. Her SBT was failed. There was no CAM assessment, and they placed it for femoral dialysis and ART lines were placed. Day four, she's at an FiO2 of 50%, PEEP of 8, RAS at -2, propofol's at 35, fentanyl's at 50, levofed is off. No SAT, SBT, CAM, or early mobility is done. Day five, she's now at FiO2 of 30%, PEEP of 5, RAS is charted -2 to +2, propofol's at 35, fentanyl's at 50. She gets a total of 4 milligrams of midazolam pushes. No SAT, no SBT, no CAM, no early mobility, and now wound care is being consulted for a dark area on her buttocks. Day six, FiO2 is 40%, PEEP's at 5, propofol's at 35, fentanyl's at 50, midazolam total is at 4 milligrams throughout the 24 hours. RAS is charted between -2 and +1. Propofol did go down and then was off for 10 minutes. The fentanyl stayed on. SBT was failed. The first CAM score is charted at positive for delirium at 1900. And this is on day six. Day seven, now her FiO2 is up to 90%. PEEP is 10. RAS is -2 to +2. Propofol is at 50. Fentanyl is at 150. She gets a total of 16 milligrams of midazolam. And now she's getting oxycodone through her feeding tube at a total of 20 milligrams per day. Day eight, her FiO2 is at 85 to 60%. PEEP is between 10 and 8. RAS is -2 to +4. Propofol is at 50. Fentanyl is at 150. She gets a total of 10 milligrams of midazolam and 40 milligrams of oxycodone. There's no SAT, SBT, or early mobility, but her CAM remains charted at positive. Day nine, she's now at a FiO2 of 50%, PEEP of 8, propofol at 50, fentanyl at 150. She gets a total of 32 milligrams of midazolam via pushes throughout those 24 hours and 40 milligrams of oxycodone. For the SAT, the propofol was briefly decreased for the SBT and the fentanyl was continued. Her RAS went up to +1, so propofol was resumed and her RAS was then charted at a -2. And she was CAM positive. Day 10, FiO2 is at 50%, PEEP's at 8, RAS is at +1 to +2, propofol is off at 8:30, and she was finally extubated to high flow. She continued on a fentanyl drip with Precedex at 0.5. She received 15 milligrams of Halidol and a total of 17 milligrams of Versed and 20 milligrams of oxycodone. No mobility, CAM positive, and the femoral devices were removed. Day 11, she starts to turn herself while on high flow. She's turning herself in the bed. That's it. Day 12, she's now on nasal cannula and she gets transferred to the chair, which being on the unit really just meant hoyered, lifted to the chair. Day 13, she now starts to take steps in the room. Day 14, she leaves AMA with a deep tissue injury, severe cognitive impairments, and requires a walker for limited mobility. Where did we go wrong?
Well, it's certainly a familiar story. I mean, different details and to different degrees. But what I always am struck with when you look at patients like that, and I mean, this sort of thing, you know, in ICUs everywhere, but by the time you get towards the end of this story, if you were to come in and take over care of this patient and you asked what's wrong with them, the only real answer you could say is that they're critically ill and not getting better. No one remembers why she came. So it's kind of like their initial period of care was like it's like an indoctrination process of converting their original complaint into ICU required complaints. We're taking your pneumonia and turning it into weakness, delirium, chronic respiratory failure, and wounds. It's like the right answer is not to say, what do you do with this patient after 2 or 3 weeks of this? It's to say, how do we prevent it from happening in the first place? Because there clearly is so much inertia and like positive feedback to it. You know, why is the patient getting this sedation? Why are they stuck on the ventilator? Why are they weak and so on? Well, because they have been. You know, they're needing the sedation because they're delirious. Why are they delirious? Because it's the sedation you gave them yesterday. Why are they weak today and can't move around? Well, because they haven't been for 2 weeks. So there's not really a pill for any of those things, but there is potentially the ability to prevent them. It's just hard to do, right? Mm-hmm. It's like the easiest thing to do is always to not do those things. You know, leave them unconscious, not moving, whatever. And you see the benefit of that right away because you get the ease. The harm of it is delayed, so you don't see that. It's like the we talked to Rory Spiegel recently about APRV. He said, you know, over-distension happens immediately and recruitment takes time to happen. Well, not doing stuff rewards you right away and the complications take time. So right. It's like the first few days is the F around period and then the next week is the find out period. It's really easy to do, but...
Yeah, and I think like you said, you said it really nicely when you said, you know, she's a meth addict. Nobody wants to mess with her. Right. That's the problem is that when we get people and we sort of start writing them off as they're this or that, you know, oh, they have really bad COPD, so there's nothing we can do. Or they're drug addicts, so what are you going to do? Right. And that's where we get into trouble. And I think Brandon makes a good point, right? Because there's really no downside in the immediate sense of doing it that way. The downside comes much later. And it's one of those things. It's like everything in life, right? If I eat like crap, I'm rewarded with crap tastes good, you know, not literally, but you know, but I'm, you know, down the road when I have diabetes or when I have, you know, hypertension or whatever, you know, nobody thinks about that when they're eating junk food. And the same thing happens here, right? The easiest thing to do would be to go back in time and don't do the bad things, but those things are hard.
Well, and hopefully you have the education to understand that when you become overweight, maybe it was what you've been doing for the past few years. But when this patient, you know, 10 days in is like not improving, I think a lot of people are not connecting the dots and saying, maybe we could have right. done something different earlier. They may see it as inevitable. Like you said, oh, she was already sick, whatever. And it could be the case, but it also could easily be the things that you did early on.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge problem. I see that a lot in the ICU and the ED particularly. You know, when I used to work in the ED, you know, the ED is a sideshow, right? To be a little more clean on our podcast. But it's stuff is going on constantly. And it's real easy when you have something bad happen to say, I mean, what are you going to do? The ED is a sideshow. But I think when we do that, we do a disservice because we don't get better. And then this is the same thing, right? Because we say, well, what are you going to do? People are real sick. You got to do this. But we just never get better at it because we never take the time to think, could we have done something differently? Yeah, we could. We just didn't. We should have.
And it's easy to look at. I mean, if you can see, I have this whole story written out in 2 pages, day by day. But when you look through our documentation, that's not how information is displayed. As an NP, mm-hmm. I'm looking at it from the nursing's perspective too, right? Because it's easy to look through and be like, 32 milligrams of Versed. Who did that to her? Okay. But there are so many gaps throughout all the disciplines in the ICU. But nurses are doing like a day shift on Monday, night shift on Wednesday, day shift on Saturday, different patients every time. So there's no continuity. In our notes as APPs, we like to put the freestyle comments. We do this exact thing, like day one, day two, here are the main events, so that whoever comes on can get a quick rundown of the timeline. So that if you're coming on day 9 and you don't know any of your patients, you can at least say, okay, she was intubated on day 1 for this. and then these certain things happened. But I don't, now that I'm looking through more medical records, I don't see that same pattern happening. So even as an APP or an MD, it's easy to get lost, especially when you're reviewing 16 patients with these complex courses before rounds that are happening in an hour, right? So it's easy to just go through these checklists. And this is, I think, a lot of what we see here is a checklist. Even checklist perspective, this wasn't done well. But they are missing the actual purpose of the bundle. It's not just to chart an SAT where probe is turned off for 10 minutes and an SBT where they get tachypnea and you just turn it back onto a controlled setting and then turn sedation back on. That's the checklist. But we have to zoom out and say, what is the bundle even for? Is it really just for extubation? And even if it is just for extubation, we shouldn't be thinking about extubation just when the ventilator settings are minimal. The real purpose of the bundle is to keep patients as awake, communicative, autonomous, and mobile as possible. And that should be our focus upon admission. I like the European version of this is eCash. In one of their articles, they said that this focus is just as important as which antibiotics to give, which kind and how much fluid to give, which ventilator settings to put them on, whether or not to sedate them, and what kind of sedatives to give is just as important upon admission, upon intubation, as anything else. Because we gave her all probably the right antibiotics, but did we do the right thing for her? Did we consider her risk factors as a methamphetamine user? She's got a fragile brain. She's at high risk of delirium. Yet we gave her deliriogenic medications. She was in septic shock, another huge risk factor for delirium. But yet we gave her deliriogenic medications. Did we think to protect her brain as much as we think to protect lungs? So we labeled her as methamphetamine user. And let's say the ED tells the nurse, we intubated her because she was agitated. So one thing that I really work with teams on is stop using subjective terms. What does agitation mean? As an ED nurse, that could mean something different than what an ICU nurse perceives, or even within the ICU, depends on who's taking care of the patient. Is that just fidgety? Or is that levitating off the bed and trying to karate chop everyone in sight, right? So no more subjective terms. So I invite them to think, okay, if you hear from the previous nurse that they were agitated, ask, what was their RAS? Now, if she was a RAS of plus one, but she's hypoxic, struggling to breathe, well, that sounds pretty reasonable. Now, if she's a RAS of plus four and she's absolutely insane, well, she might be on a methamphetamine high. That's going to change how I manage her for the next 12 hours or so. She may need sedation. But everyone needs to be asking after intubation, does she have an indication for sedation? We right now have a conveyor belt where it's as soon as you put the tube in, you're grabbing propofol. Now, if they have a paralytic on board, you may need that for a while. Once that paralytic has worn off, we need to be circling back to, is there an actual indication for sedation? Because what we do on the front end, especially with someone like this, is going to determine the back end. It is easier to prevent delirium and ICU-acquired weakness than it is to rehabilitate it on the back end. So if we were really practicing the bundle and we were thinking, okay, how do we keep her awake, communicative, autonomous, and mobile? That would change what we did in the first 12 hours of her admission. If she wasn't on a methamphetamine high, could we have had her awake, writing on a clipboard? She would have had her cognition and her fine motor skills intact to be able to tell us what she needed as far as pain management, anxiety, who she wanted to be there. Then if we'd done that on day two, I'm looking at day two, FiO2 is 50%, PEEP was 8. But that's while she is writing the vent, which brings me to another point. I do not trust our RAS scores. When I have teams do manual audits, 50 to 70% of their RAS scores on average are inaccurate. So she's charted at a RAS of negative 2, but I could see looking at her vent settings and her vital signs that she was riding the vent the entire time. So I don't know at what point, you know, per RAS, do we stop taking spontaneous breaths, but I'm suspicious. If a RAS of negative 2 is opening your eyes to voice, making eye contact for less than 10 seconds, you should probably be taking some spontaneous breaths is my speculation. So I don't trust that she was at a RAS of negative 2. So if she's at 50% of PEEP of 8, if we had her awake and sitting up and clearing her secretions, would that help drive down her ventilator settings? But we're not doing that. We're not doing pulmonary toileting. So she remains there. Also, she's on, would she have been on less levofed? Could we have been titrating down her vasopressins if her propofol wasn't at 30? I don't know. But at least by day three, where her FiO2 is at 40%, pressure support at 5 and PEEP of 8, she should have been getting a full SAT. She should have been at least sitting at the side of the bed, probably walking around. We should have had her extubated, is my speculation. But we didn't do that at all. Rather, when she popped up to a RASA plus 1, we resumed sedation. So then now she's sedated because she's intubated and intubated because she's sedated. And now that continues on repeat until day 10. And she developed pressure injury, a ventilator-associated pneumonia, delirium. And the response to delirium, like you said, Brandon, was to give more sedation. When would we ever give bacteria in response to sepsis? But we did that. And we do that. Like, that's a normal thing. This is not to, like, blast one ICU. This is, we have to confront it in order to fix it. But the teams are not trained to know how to manage, quote, agitation. And that's the thing. You have a methamphetamine user, and the night shift says, oh, yeah, she was agitated, so I gave her Versed. But what does agitated mean? Her max RAS for the first bit was plus 2. That I can work with. But do we have to drop her down to a negative 2? Really, probably negative 4, because she had been a plus 2 at one point during her awakening trial.
So do you think the gap is usually just not prioritizing these things and people understand why they're so critical, or not having the skills to manage them? For example, the, quote, agitated patient. Do we just have to convince people that it's best to not sedate them, and if they do, to do it as little as possible? Or do we have to teach them how to manage the patient, you know, non-pharmacologically?
All of it. So when I train teams, I do webinars before I even come on site, and they're mandated to be participated and watched by every member of the team, because it's a waste of my time to come and do simulation training to talk about the how. Like, those non-pharmacological interventions don't mean anything. No one will take that seriously. To say, hold their hand and talk to them, right? Try to give them a clipboard. That doesn't mean anything unless they understand the harm and the lethal consequences of sedation. Until they understand that propofol is a mitochondrial toxin, that it's deliriogenic, that delirium is an acute brain injury or brain failure, that it causes long-term cognitive impairments that are like mild Alzheimer's and moderate traumatic brain injury, that it doubles the risk of dying. Unless we understand that, me talking them through their anxiety means nothing. But if they realize that giving them a pen and paper can help them calm down, and mobilizing them is going to help them calm down, get off the ventilator, be easier to manage, and give them quality of life and drastically improve their chances of survival, now our teams are interested in developing that skill, because it is a skill that our teams don't have. So it's easy to talk about early mobility, but when it comes to down to it, we don't know how to do it. Like, how many times we practice running a code for ACLS training, right? We understand role clarity. We understand the process, but we don't have that kind of structured training for early mobility. So we're expecting them to do something that they've never really been trained on, that they're terrified of, and they don't understand why they're doing it. So of course it's not going to really launch. And I think some of the challenges with this is we're only doing this on the back end. So if you look at something like the TEAM study, on average, the TEAM study, these patients were sedated at a RAS of negative 3 for the first 6 days. Then they were mobilized. And that's being touted as being very progressive and mobility. But that would have been hard. I mean, day 6, she's already really delirious. Now she's weak. She's going to be impulsive. She's stressful. You have two patients. So someone like her, you're like, I don't know, can she breathe on her own if she loses her tube? Is she going to be okay? And culturally, a nurse letting someone self-extubate is the ultimate failure. So no one's going to be willing to risk taking sedation off and leaving it off on her while they have to go run, check their other patient. So now we've created this mess that we don't know how to manage. Whereas if she'd been awake on day 1, yeah, she was probably a fidgety, anxious person, but nothing like the delirious, dare I say, hot mess that she became. So would it have been easier and more feasible to have her awake on day one, kept her brain as intact as possible, kept her strong enough to communicate, strong enough to move herself. She could have gotten herself up to the chair by herself. She could have walked around by herself with someone just pushing the ventilator. That would have been easier than now, 10 days later, she requires 2-3 people to move her. So it's the timing of it as well that makes it so much more complex when now we're rehabilitating them rather than prehabilitating them.
I think you bring up a good point too about education, because I think we saw this, you know, several years ago when it sort of became more in vogue to get Foley's out, right? And we got tons of pushback from nurses because taking Foley out makes your job harder, right? It just does. And nurses would, and this was happening sort of when I was transitioning from being a nurse to being an NP. And I, as a nurse, I would argue the same things, right? That, well, I can't get accurate urine output and blah, blah, blah. But when you start to see the data that you're causing harm by leaving this Foley in and things are going to get better, then I have nurses now who come to me and say, hey, is there any reason I can't take this Foley out? Because I think ultimately we all want to do what's best for the patients, right? Nobody wants to harm patients just because it makes our life easier. But I think when we don't understand that what we're doing causes harm, then yeah, we do want to err on the side of making our lives easier. And so if it's easier to sedate a patient, but hey, what's the downside? No downside? Great, let's do it. Let's be easy. But I think if you understand that, you know, there's a huge downside and you're making things worse for your patient, then I think everybody's going to want to do the right thing and try to do that better, right?
Well, I think you've got a gun from both sides, right? You help people understand why it's important, but also make it easy to do the right thing and maybe hard to. So for, you know, now a lot of places have, you know, external urinary catheters for men and, you know, for women as well. If you didn't have that, would more Foley's be in? Probably, because you don't have another option that's as easy. So, you know, making that kind of thing available. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, one of the things I'll often do when you have people on sedative and opioid drips, yeah, you can convince people to try to wean them. But maybe I'll also, like, write the order so that it maxes out at a kind of low dose. Because when I leave shift and it's the middle of the night or, you know, whatever, somebody else has other things on their mind, it's one more step for someone to you know, crank this up to a higher dose.
Yeah.
I mean, that may, like, it may seem like you're, I don't know, it almost seems like I have a dim view of the people around me. But there is always a practical element to what people are doing, you know? If you make it really hard to do the right thing, you know, good, smart people are going to do the wrong thing and vice versa.
Yeah, no, that's a good point, right? I think you're right. That not only do we have to know better, but it does have to be easier to do.
And that's where I am so passionate about doing this on the front end, because I've done awakening trials as a nurse and hated them. It just feels like when you start sedation, you're biting off the top of a grenade and you're passing it down shift to shift to shift. And then it becomes your turn to take it off because now ventilator settings are minimal. Now we can take it off, which is unfounded. You could take it off whenever there's not an indication for sedation. But now we're trying to get them extubated, and now you have this whole hot mess to deal with while your patient in the other room is bleeding out. Right? And so that doesn't seem important while you're trying to run a rapid infuser in the other room. And so it makes everything stressful. So there's a lot of anxiety, a lot of hesitation, a lot of bitterness. I have found when I'm training teams, this brings up lots of trauma from the pandemic, a lot of the political problems that, like, it gets projected because they perceive that they're being asked to do more without receiving more support. So I think it is important. I've gotten teams mobility techs, additional nurses, because the financial benefits of this are so vast. But in reality, when they get to the point in which they're actually doing this early on, they're keeping patients awake right away, mobilizing them promptly, it's so much easier. So one hospital, I got them 3 mobility techs amongst 5 ICUs. But there was so much drama, or there were complications in getting them hired and trained. We'd already launched this program. So 6 months into it, now they're getting mobility techs, but now they have most of their patients awake and mobile already without those mobility techs because they gained the skill set. So it's an evolution. That same hospital, they emailed me and they're like, no way. It took us 30 minutes to get someone to the chair. We cannot do this for every patient. And I said, absolutely, you cannot do that for every patient. But think of it like pronation. It took you 8 people and 45 minutes to get someone prone initially. Now you flip them like pancakes with three people. Same process happens with early mobility. You develop that skill set. There are skills that I didn't even think about as skills, like how to communicate with patients that are intubated, nonverbal communication, how to work them through being on the ventilator, how to manage the ventilator in a way that is optimized for the patient. Like there's just so many skills that we're not trained. So it's kind of crazy that we have these programs where we intubate patients, but we don't know how to get them off the ventilator. And yet we're expected to do all these things, but we don't know how. And when there's a lot that actually does go into it, but we make it more complicated when we do it in this process. And I thought this was a good example of how this increases workload too. Between this case study and another one, I estimated 10 to 12 extra days on the ventilator between two patients and a 22-bed ICU. So if you have eight patients intubated in that ICU and you're increasing their time on the ventilator by like 5 to 12 days, I mean, that's a lot of work. But we're not really, we're so used to it. It's so normalized that we don't recognize how much extra work and harm it is.
Yeah, it's like if you hired a guy to work on your roof or something and it should take a couple days and every time you come and check on them, they're like dropping bricks and having to pick them up and they're digging a hole and then filling the hole back in or something. You're like, well, this is why it's taken you so long. And most of what you're doing is just like fixing what you just made happen. If you had just done the original thing only. I mean, honestly, what it makes me sometimes wonder is if in many of these cases, I mean, obviously there are many measures you could do to avoid the complications, but maybe one thing we could do is just recognize that the trajectory for many of the you know admitting illnesses we see in the ICU is a lot shorter than we thought. And the person who comes in with pneumonia and needs to be intubated and so on, they may recover from that in a few days at most. And so if they're like 5 days, 7 days in and they're stuck on the ventilator, it's not because of the pneumonia anymore. It's just because they're like on the ventilator and sedated and delirious and all this stuff. So maybe just take that away. Like maybe we just, you just like, you know, take them off the ventilator, stop their sedation, whatever. And the reason we don't do that is because the things themselves are perpetuating themselves. Like, well, you know, he's not giving us a good breathing trial. And that's one of the reasons I encourage people to like ask, you know, why that is. And usually it's because they're either too sedated, and then you can that's up to you. You can stop them being sedated, or they're like restless or tachypneic, they're agitated. But if the reason is just because they don't like being on the ventilator and they're confused, yeah, maybe you just take them off. It's like if you're hoping for everyone to convince you how well they are, they end up never making any progress. But maybe we just say these people are better. Let's just get them out of here, rather than like allowing them to kind of be in this mire until they like can absolutely convince you with like notarized proofs that they're better. You just like believe they are better. Like, you know, this guy was here for a broken hip and his hip's not broken anymore. So let's just like move him
along. But we also make that picture so much cloudier when we've now gone 3-5 days of sedation. If we're waiting until ventilator settings are minimal to now care about the brain, we're going to cause so much damage and then have to clean it up. So let's say you do get that patient extubated 5 days after being intubated for pneumonia, but they're probably going to be delirious. They're probably going to be weak. Even extubated, they're going to be extra work. We've still already done some damage. Yes, they're off the ventilator, so the RTs have an easier job, but as a nurse, like that's going to be a fun patient to take care of now that they're extubated. And so something that I have teams do is to ask after intubation every day, every rounds, what is the indication for sedation? If we ask that one question, as well as how are they communicating? Because I'll hear in rounds, they're RASA negative one. Okay, how are they communicating? And I get this bewildered look like, what do you mean communication? Well, can they write in a clipboard? So if you talk to them and they open their eyes, well, now like, give them a clipboard. Now that you're stimulating them, they should be more arousable, right? And there's no expectation for patients to communicate. So now when they become a RASA plus one or plus two, why? The RAS is not a comfort scale. Just because you have a low RAS does not mean that they are sleeping or comfortable. It just means that we have now chemically restrained their psychomotor activity. And if they have a RASA plus one or plus two, something's causing that. But do we have the skill set or the insight to evaluate, to know how to understand what they need and treat those needs. Now they're RASA plus three or plus four, that might need some sedation, but then do you have to go from a RASA plus four to a RASA negative three or even negative two? For example, if they have delirium, like this patient exactly, she had delirium. So maybe if she was really, I mean, at one point she was a RASA plus four, maybe she needed a little bit of Precedex to get to like a RASA plus one and then mobilize her. We need to see mobility as a tool for extubation as well as agitation and delirium management. Yes, obviously it benefits the musculoskeletal system, but it also helps the psychology, the pulmonary system, like everything is benefited by mobility, but we see it as like a back-end rehabilitative tool instead of a front-end preventative prehabilitative tool. So we're just not really trained to understand why patients are having these symptoms, this psychomotor activity. Instead, we are trained to mask it with sedation. So if they will ask, how are they communicating and is there an indication for sedation? That alone will transform how we approach managing these kind of patients.
Well, give us some tools here. I mean, I know you're not here to give us a seminar, but you know, let's say we talk the nurse into, you know, holding the sedative drip, and they say, you know, now the patient's eyes are open and he looks restless and uncomfortable in his RAS is at plus one or plus two or something. What should they do? Like what should their next step be?
You know, so let's say I'm coming on shift and everyone before me has had this patient sedated. And maybe they did an SAT yesterday and they came out, quote, agitated, right? Whatever that means. I'm going to approach the waking trial very strategically. I'm not going to do it at 5 a.m. in a dark room with no one else there, right? I'm going to have family there, especially if I know that they have delirium. I'm going to make sure that we do everything possible to get sedation off. I don't want teams seeing awakening trials as interruption, break, holidays, vacations. I hate those words. Some patients, maybe intracranial hypertension, okay, their ICP went up. That was a failed trial. Resume it. But most of our patients, it should be working towards sedation cessation. So we're going to approach that with all the tools possible to make that successful. So family, number one. If they have family available, having the family be there talking to them. If they're delirious, they're going to need a lot of repeated orientation. That as a nurse, you don't always have the patience for or the time for, but give families a job. Your job is to hold the clipboard for them, help them write, see if they can write. And again, that's hard 3 to 5 days after because now they've lost that fine motor skill. But try. Tell them where they are on repeat. Ask them yes or no simple questions. Are you in pain? Do the CAM screening tool so you understand their perspective. If they have delirium, you know that they may not retain what you're telling them. They may not understand. One of the things that I would especially do is mobilize them, get them at least sitting up at the side of the bed. Now, our teams culturally think that patients have to be following commands to mobilize. They're terrified if a patient can't follow commands. But one of the most common reasons for not following commands is delirium. And one of the most powerful tools we have to treat delirium is mobility. So if we have this thought process of we can't mobilize them because they have the delirium, then we take away one of the best tools to intervene. So I don't want the nurses to have to deal with a patient at a RASA plus two the rest of their shift. So let's treat it. Let's figure out what's causing it. Address those causes. So if it's pain, they're worried about their dog not being fed in the apartment. They've had this terrible delirium that their kids are kidnapped. Let's address those things as best as we can. But let's also get them up mobilized. At least, again, sitting at the side of the bed where they're bearing their own weight, their feet are on the ground, and help them come back to reality and then continue to try to work through the reorientation.
What would you say to the nurse who says, well, that's fine, but they seem uncomfortable, and I don't want them to be uncomfortable. That may be for no other reason, or at least so we perceive from having a tube in their throat. And so maybe your first reaction could be treating pain, but maybe you ask the patient and they say they're not in pain per se. Maybe they've been on a bunch of opioids, but they still are maybe uncomfortable. How can we improve their level of comfort, especially if we're kind of not sure what it even is that's bothering them?
I mean, the root of all of this is understanding that sedation is not necessarily comfortable. So that's where this deep sense of humanity leads us to give something that we perceive as being comfortable, humane sleep, right? 2019 study of nurses showed that 68% felt like sedation was necessary for patient comfort. This is why I won't even go on site to work through this stuff until we hear from survivors that they thought kids were burning for days. They thought their deceased father was eating them on repeat. They need to understand what it's actually like when they're sedated. And then what does discomfort look like? Now, if they're a RASS of plus 3 or plus 4, that's dangerous behavior. They may need some sedation. But we need to be less afraid of patients moving. We need to celebrate movement. So a RASS of plus 1 or plus 2, that's okay, but we need to figure out what's causing it. And if they're just hyperactive delirious, at a RASS of plus 1, at least they're moving. But then we probably do need family at the bedside. We probably need, I would love for these patients to be prioritized as a sitter. I know that's not happening. So then we go to the default of, well, let's just sedate them. And now we just perpetuate, right? If they're RASS of plus 1 or plus 2 because of delirium and we sedate them, we're not treating the delirium. We're not treating acute brain failure. And in this case study, she went 6 days without any delirium screening. How often do we go 6 days without checking a creatinine in the ICU? Right? So we need to understand as best as we can what's causing this discomfort. Treat it if it's pain, if it's fear. This is where it gets tricky because this requires critical thinking. Sedation is easy in the sense of it's a conveyor belt. There's no critical thinking needed. It's very predictable. But every human is different, and we do need to treat them differently. So discomfort is a tricky one, but we can treat a lot of anxiety, a lot of these psychomotor activities with family, communication, sitting up the side of the bed, which ICU nurses will roll their eyes at me and think that's too fluffy. Give me some probe. Give me a Versed push. Right? I've got to have full control. But once they actually see this in action, they realize how powerful it is and how much better these patients do, then we start to get real momentum going. But we have to at least give it a try before we turn to chemical restraints.
How much of this is, do you think, a matter of our convenience? And I don't necessarily mean like lazy nurses, lazy respiratory therapists who just want life easy, but someone dictates X has to be done. And maybe even puts a, you know, like you were talking about spontaneous awakening trials being done in the dark, in the early mornings. You know, the number of times that I have gone to see a patient at like 6:30 in the morning and am told by the night shift nurse they failed their SBT. Well, you guys did SBT already? What were the settings? What did it look like? And no one knows. Nobody can tell me because some, you know, the surgeon, the surgery service maybe has said, you know, we're going to round at 5 o'clock and we want all the SBTs done before we round. And so they go in and just turn off the sedation and put them on 5/5 of pressure support and they fail within 30 seconds. And so they say, check, box checked, we failed. They're back on.
And no family there, of course, because it was outside.
Right. And they're, and they're like, the sedation was just barely turned off. It's been on for 3 days. Right. Like in this case, fentanyl is still running. They turn off probe, so it's, quote, an awakening trial. They're at 20 degrees.
Right.
Laying there in bed. Yeah. So this is, we could do a whole thing on breathing trials and awakening trials, but I have a bubble map. You can look at my LinkedIn. I just recently posted it where I go through some of the main causes of failed breathing trials: tachypnea, hypoxia, apnea, low tidal volumes. A lot of those things are linked down to ICU acquired weakness and delirium, which are both treated by mobility. But yet culturally, I hear this all the time. Well, let's get them extubated. Let's do an SBT and get them extubated, and then we'll mobilize them. Well, then they fail their SBT. Then they get resedated. They don't get mobilized. We do the same thing tomorrow. When really we need to be saying day one, we need to mobilize them, you know, if possible, unless there's a contraindication to mobility, which are far more rare than inclusion criteria. Let's mobilize them so that when their pneumonia is better, they'll have the respiratory muscles and the cognition to get successfully extubated. We shouldn't be thinking through extubation just when the ventilator settings are minimal. But even if we are doing that, like you said, Brian, why did they fail? We're just looking at numbers. So this is not just on RTs. This is not just on RNs. This is everyone. So in her case, every day, I mean, day three, her first breathing trial, the RT should have said she was tachypnic and should have said, I don't know why she was tachypnic. Let's talk about it. Did she have diaphragm dysfunction or was she anxious? Was she in pain? Does she have delirium? Let's treat those things. And then let's try another SBT. I really think we could have gotten her extubated on day two or three. But instead, we did this whole thing. Here are the numbers. Maybe the RT communicated to the nurse. Maybe they didn't. Maybe the nurse during rounds had to go look into the charting and say, okay, they failed. Okay, then what's the APP doing? Where's the physician on this saying? Why? Instead, they're like, they hear from the RN, failed SAT, a failed SBT, and the physician or APP running around shrugs and says, okay, we'll try again tomorrow. I mean, this is where, and where are the OTs and PTs saying, well, can I work with her? Like, she's still on the ventilator? Great, I need to get her off the ventilator. Let me go in. Can I get an order? None of that happened. So it's not just the nurses giving her 32 milligrams of Versed, not just the RTs just robotically charting numbers without critically thinking. It's the entire team just looking at today and just looking at numbers and looking at the bundle as a checklist rather than the whole picture of how do we keep her awake, communicative, autonomous, and mobile? And why is she failing her trials? Why is she still sedated? No one's asking the why. And we end up causing a lot of harm, work, and expense.
Yeah, I think you're right. The why is so critically important. And I'll hear this, especially with some of our surgery patients, you know, when we ran with the surgery team and the intern will say they failed their SBT. Well, why did they fail their SBT? I don't know. They just said they did. Okay, well, then say that's not, then they didn't get an SBT, right? So if you can't tell me why it didn't happen, so go, let's go do it again. And, you know, I've lost track of the number of times that I've been told they failed SBT. And when we go back and say in the daytime and say, you know, well, let's hold the sedation for 30 minutes and let's do this and let's do this. And we end up extubating people because it's more than just a check box of, we did an SBT, they failed, so check. Like you said, we'll try again tomorrow.
Well, I think we see the pulmonary system is just lungs, and we don't realize that it's also muscles and brain. And I think even, like, there's so much psychology behind it, right? Like, obviously, anxiety, agitation, pain, those can cause those numbers on an SBT to fail. So someone like that, surgery says they failed, I don't know why, I would say, well, let's go in there and sit them up. If they fail after they've been sat up, I'm going to have a lot more information about what we need to do to get them to pass.
Right.
But I'm seeing these SBTs happen where they're barely off sedation, or they're off sedation and now they're RASA negative 2 because they still have it in their body, or they have hypoactive delirium. They're at 20 degrees laying there in bed because they slid down and they do an SBT like that. I want to see these patients hustled, have their brains cleared out, their lungs cleared out, be really awake, really have that sedation metabolized, and now do an SBT. But when you only see SBTs as a checklist for one time that morning without understanding what goes into passing, we end up on this cycle of rinse and repeat for 7 extra days than needed.
Well, some of this goes down to the test characteristics of the tool of the SBT. I mean, you're going to say somebody passes or fails, it implies that by meeting those criteria, what the real question we're asking is, if we took this tube out, will this patient be able to breathe and not require us to put it back in? And if somebody, you put them on pressure support and they're tachypneic or restless or whatever, does that mean they won't be able to breathe with this tube out? I don't know. I mean, the real question is there anything wrong with their lungs? And a lot of the time, if the patient has been here for 10 days, no. I mean, maybe they have some pulmonary edema. Maybe they have respiratory weakness. What else could be wrong with them? Maybe they have a new VAP, I suppose. But I mean, if it's not one of those things, then there's probably nothing wrong with them. You know, how many people are tachypneic or restless who are not intubated? I mean, lots of them, and they do just fine.
But even someone like, let's say, 10 days into it, and they're tachypneic, I do worry about their diaphragm and their respiratory muscles. So I do worry about extubating them because I'm like, are they going to be able to protect their airway, clear the secretions, maintain the work of breathing? So why not mobilize them while they're intubated? They can get some extra support so we can rehabilitate them so that they're safer to extubate. I find in these cases that those kind of patients get barely extubated. They sit there on high flow, they aspirate, and then they get reintubated and then resedated. And we never actually treat the reason why they were reintubated. We just put them back on the conveyor belt.
Well, right. You know, diagnose them with respiratory weakness and then treat that. I mean, that's a very different thing than just saying, well, this patient didn't pass, so another
Absolutely.
Day on the ventilator.
Yeah.
What's your perspective on the use of restraints? Because I feel like a lot of time when you're going to talk about sedation, it might be a matter of like, look, I can leave this patient awake if I can restrain them and they're not going to pull their tube out, or I can take the restraints off and knock them out, but not both. Or maybe the wild card is if someone can sit with them, like family, or we can get a sitter. But if you can't get one of those two things, then maybe. So would you rather have a patient, of course, none of the above would be best, but would you rather have a patient who was restrained but more awake, or vice versa?
That was restrained and more awake. So we know that with the 2019 ADA-F bundle study, even though there was a what I would consider a fairly marginal level of compliance, they still found that physical restraint use decreased by over 60%. That's because delirium decreased by 25 to 50%. So there's a really strong correlation, obviously, between restraints and delirium. We know that restraints can cause delirium, but I think a lot of times our patients are restrained because they're delirious. So I am confident that if we don't resume one of the main causes of delirium, we can decrease the duration in which they have restraints. I obviously worry that restraints cause trauma, absolutely, but just because they're sedated and unrestrained doesn't mean that they're not having super traumatic experiences under sedation. So I'd rather them be RASO plus one or two, kind of pulling on the restraints, hyperactive delirious, coughing, clearing out their secretions, using their upper body strength, using their diaphragm to do the little crunches in bed, then laying there flaccid. Right now, if they're three or four and they're really going for the tube, I have no problem giving some Presidex, but I don't want them to be a negative two. I want to be able to come in and mobilize them. I want them to turn themselves. I want them to be doing at least their in-bed activity. So if they're putting their legs up on the bed, I'm like, great, you're leaving your legs against gravity. I see that as you're engaging your diaphragm. That's going to help you get off the ventilator. That's going to help do pulmonary toileting. But that's not the perspective that we use. And again, what ends up happening is we get them off the ventilator sooner, we get them out of delirium sooner, and we end up sedating them or restraining them less. So it's pretty backwards for teams to say, we are a no restraint unit, and then to have most of their patients that are RASA negative four chemically restrained. Mm-hmm. That's not helping outcomes at all.
So in the restrained sedated patient, you would say get the sedation off first and then the restraints, but of course aim
yes,
for
and, both. And so when you are doing this process of start sedation and then later on, we're going to start lightening sedation, many of your patients are going to be restrained. My perspective and my experience is when you prevent delirium, you don't cause it with sedation. You may have some patients with sepsis or whatever that do have delirium, but many of your patients are not going to be delirious. They're going to be safer. And some of those patients I found will actually ask for restraints at night. I know that I would because I am a sleepwalker. I wouldn't trust myself. So they want to be loosely restrained, know that if they wake up in the middle of the night, they're not going to get confused. That's a different level of trauma than someone that thinks that they're kidnapped and now they're restrained. So again, a lot of it comes down to timing. How soon are we doing this? When we do this right away and they can tell us what they need, their panic's going to go down. Their delirium's going to be prevented. I've had many patients, I mean, most patients will say, protect my tube. Like they'll write on the clipboard, be careful of my tube. They know that that's their lifeline because their cognition's intact. Not every patient, but many patients. But we don't get to experience that when we automatically start these neurotoxic meds on everybody. Now we're trying to take them off on everybody and everybody's confused and everybody has to have restraints. I also think that it's really important to mobilize them right away because the E is the element of the bundle to always come last. But I think it's very difficult and even dangerous to have patients unrestrained, awake, and not be mobilizing them because it's such a powerful tool to manage anxiety and delirium. You have so many risk factors for delirium in the ICU period. You've got to keep their brains intact, and that requires mobility. So people are like, we'll start with awakening trials and then we'll get to mobility later. Well, you got to kind of do mobility right away in order to be able to keep patients free of sedation.
Brian, what else should we touch on?
I think it's good just to run through the actual case and just see, you know, because like you said, hindsight is helpful, especially when the benefits are not immediately apparent up front, right? It's just like we going back to my analogy of eating junk food, right? If I could go back in time to my 20s and go, you should eat better and take better care of yourself, you would save yourself a lot of headache. Well, I would do it, right? But so I think it's good to go through these cases and see, you know, the benefits and stuff. And I think Brandon's point about making it easier. So I think the two-prong attack is make it easier to do the right thing and educate people on why it's the right thing. Because when people know that it's not just, you know, some new initiative from management to do the thing, right? You know, I mean, I think we see this all the time with the people who come around and complain about, you know, caudies and CLABSIs and other of these events that people track, right? We go, yeah, but who cares, right? It's just this metric that you're measuring. But when you see that it's actually more than just some metric, some box to check, then it makes it more, it makes it easier, I guess, to want to do the right thing. And then, like Brandon said, make it easier then to actually do the right thing and you get success.
Well, and I like your example of the diet, because what's difficult about all of this is that there is not one simple thing. As much as we all want that one diet where we just, you know, take a pill and it really is woven into all of the little decisions you make throughout the day and kind of changing your whole way of looking at the patients and of practicing critical care. Mm-hmm. And you just have to kind of keep doing it and have a whole different set of habits and have it woven into your culture. So that's why it's hard. And that's why you have to have this whole new skill set and have everyone on board with it and kind of keep it in the back of your mind as a goal. A lot of it's not complicated. It's just hard, like, you know, living a healthy lifestyle.
Well, and it's even harder, I think, going along with that analogy. Many of us have been born into a very sedentary family. We never did sports growing up. We never learned how to eat healthy. And now as adults, now that we're very developed and stuck in this rut, now we're trying to go back and change so much of the fibers of our teams. It takes a lot of psychology to change your lifestyle. Mm-hmm. It takes a lot of psychology to change how your team operates as a whole.
When you're still surrounded, yes. I mean, good luck being the only person trying to change your lifestyle in a household or a workplace full of people.
And I've
doing
had
something
podcast
else.
Listeners that it just bless their hearts. I mean, they have given their blood, sweat, and tears to bring these changes. And the hard thing is that when you see it this way, you can't unsee it. So here they are listening to my survivors. They're listening to these podcast episodes, and they walk into their units, and they're like, "Oh, here's the exact kind of damage that we're talking about," and they're the only ones. So I've unfortunately had some people leave critical care because of the moral injury to be the only ones, especially during COVID. I do feel like the tides are changing. People are more open to this. I think we were just so overwhelmed during COVID, but we also saw so clearly how much damage this causes that I think people are a little bit more open, but it's still a struggle.
All right, Kaylee, any parting thoughts?
No, I appreciate you caring about this and having me on the podcast again. I love your podcast. And again, episode 31 is the full awake and walking approach. I guess not even full, because that patient, that example, she had been transferred from an outside facility. So if you ever want to talk about starting from day one in an awake and walking ICU, we can do that too.
Yeah, there's so much to get into, so many nuances to these topics. We should spend more time on it. But I'm glad you could join us today, and I'm glad everyone listened. Remember, we're all just sharing our own opinions here, not those of our institutions, and not offering you guys any specific medical advice, just some general education. We'll talk to you next time.